Good afternoon and welcome to United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. Today we're having a special program, what we call a public forum. And actually all our meetings here are open to the public and somewhat of an interchange of ideas. But it's going to allow us in a relaxed atmosphere to spend more time exploring a particular theme in depth and breadth through the process of presentation of ideas, questions and answers, sort of along the line of the symposia, as mentioned in Plato, where the participants would be relaxing and interchange of ideas, and one would lead to the other, and they might start out with a general theme, and before you know it, they were exploring the complexities of nature and man. So these forums then give us that opportunity. And today we're going to take up the topic, what you don't know about karma. And we think that's a suitable subject for a forum because, for one reason, of course, karma has more and more worked itself into the public consciousness and public expression, but many people using the term don't have the philosophical background and experience to appreciate the wide applicability and implications. So in a sense, they know the word, but they really don't know the impact of that idea and doctrine in their lives. And the other reason it's important is we may think we know something about karma, but we think that you'll find that the more we have presented today, more questions are going to open up, because we're going to see behind every answer there's several doors in which we could continue to explore. And if we don't finish today, which is most likely, we hope that you'll continue to try to answer those questions on your own. So the format will be, this morning we'll have three brief presentations, approximately 10 minutes, and after each presentation there will be an equal amount of time for questions and answers. And then at the end of the program this afternoon, we will have an extended period of time for questions and answers that may have not come up during the program. There will be a 15-minute break between the two sessions. Just so that you are aware, the talks will be running around 8 to 10 minutes, and about 9 minutes into the talk, if the person hasn't stopped already, the moderator will stand up briefly as a gentle reminder and sit down that they should be drawing their conclusions. So our first subject, a very natural one we want to ask, is what is karma? And we'll have this idea presented and then welcome your questions.
Good morning. Well, why must I bear these burdens? Some would say, because that other guy did you evil, and you're a victim. It's karma. Why must I bear these burdens? Others would say, well, you know what? It's all due to chance. You never know how the chips are going to fall. It's just karma. But others might say, well, you bear these burdens because you asked for them, and you're reaping what you've sown. It's karma. In popular culture, there are some misunderstandings about what karma is, and just as importantly, misunderstandings about what karma is not. So today we're going to attempt to separate the wheat from the chaff on this topic of karma and just investigate, really, what is karma? The ideas we present, certainly none of us claim personal authority over them. However, we invite all to look into the truth of the ideas themselves. To the extent that we can see the truth of the ideas, to that extent is their authority. The authority lies in the truth and our ability to understand it and see it. Could we consider karma as the ultimate law in the universe? Certainly, the philosophy tells us that it is. Is it reasonable to consider karma inflexible and wholly just? Could it be the origin and fount of all other laws in nature? Well, if we view karma as that universal law which adjusts the effect to its original cause of everything on every plane in the universe, physical, psychic, mental, all planes of being, then it would seem to be the dominant force. Karma, we are told, proceeds intelligently and equitably. It ties each effect to its cause and each cause to the producer of that cause. Although karma, in capital letters, is actually not knowable, its effects are perceivable, and we can describe it. So let's describe karma. We can describe karma because we can feel its effects. In fact, without a being to feel its effects or to make it, there is no karma. The being upon whom the effects come experiences pain or pleasure, and that being is the very cause of those effects. We can view this simply as adjustments in nature, impersonal adjustments according to law. These are adjustments for which the individual who experiences the effect is responsible. So these adjustments, as they proceed, are continual and continuous. Karma is continual in the sense that it is constant, all-pervading, and never ceasing. It is continuous in that the effects of karma come about according to cycles, when the conditions on any given plane are right for certain karmic effects to express themselves, then we experience the karma. That's not to say it didn't exist continuously since the cause of it, though, but the conditions are right on a given plane according to the tide of the cycles. The law of karma is universal in scope. It is the dominant law in nature. And there is no point in all of the manifested universe which is exempt from the sway of karma. From the moral character of a single child to the events of an entire nation. From the atom to the elemental. From the effects that a musician has on the people listening to him, all the way up to the processes inherent in the evolution of a solar system, karma is the dominant law, all the way up to the great inward and outward breath of Brahma, it is said. So in our efforts to answer this question today, what is karma? This doctrine of karma, together with its twin doctrine of reincarnation are the, it is the canon of hope and responsibility, which is to say, if we accept the personal responsibility for all the burdens that we bear and accept that they are our own chickens that have come home to roost, then we have taken a step in the direction of him who recognizes his own creative power to transform those burdens into lessons, and he has the reasonable basis to hope for an ever more harmonious life.
It's interesting that in the presentation, the idea was presented that karma operates on all beings, from the lower to the higher, and that as it adjusts, the individual experiences pleasure and pain in accordance of the causes they set up. But what about, for example, in the animal kingdom? We see that they obviously suffer and enjoy. Are they responsible? Have they set up the causes by which they suffer and enjoy in this life? And if not, how does karma operate for them?
Well, so how does karma operate on the lower kingdoms? Certainly the lower kingdoms are not at the point where they can or would take responsibility for anything that comes to them, but really what does come to them is the effect of how we, the human race, think, act, and speak. Subtract the human, or extract the human race from the equation, and all of great nature is in perfect harmony. Add the human race to great nature, and the opportunity is there for great nature to continue on an evolutionary path which is far beyond that which it could have reached without the human race affecting it. The power in the human race is there to raise all of life, but based on how we think, act, and speak. But when we are not aware of how our karma affects everything else, we also have the power to degrade, or, just to degrade all of life. So therein lies our own responsibility. All of those disproportionate, or rather inharmonious, all of those inharmonious things that go on in great nature really go on because of our own thoughts and actions among ourselves and how we treat and value and use great nature. Yes?
What is the relationship between time and karma? You know, how does that work? Is there some observation of that you came across that you can give us?
What is the relationship between time and karma? Does time play into cause and effect? Well, it would be helpful if we look at that question from the perspective of is there a relationship according to the cycles between cause and effect, and it really depends on the conditions of the plane where the cause has been put into effect. In other words, if a cause is put into effect and the conditions are right for that effect to be experienced immediately, perhaps then it would be. But the real question is, are the conditions right? So, for instance, if we plant the seed in August, are the conditions right for it to germinate and receive the full force of the spring sun and do all these things to come to full bloom before the winter hits? No. So time is involved there. And if we were to, if 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 we were to take the time to learn the cycles of whatever it is, of whatever causes we're putting into effect, such as the cycles of the seasons, and use those cycles and work with those cycles, then the reaping of what we sow will come according, we will have the greatest harvest.
Actually, the relevance of time and karma will be discussed further in our third presentation this morning. So, can I go up?
Down here. Yes, in the middle, ma'am? Yes.
I think you said that karma affects the breathing of the in-breathing and ex-breathing of the spirit or the higher power. Would you elaborate on how karma is affected and how those two interact?
Well, we understand that this allegory or this idea of the in-breathing and the out-breathing of Brahma it describes the cyclic manifestation of the universe and then the absorption of that manifested universe back into Brahma itself. So this all proceeds according to the law of cycles, which is in many ways synonymous with the law of karma, because the cycle that begins with the next out-breath is a function of the previous cycle that had been completed. So really everything that goes on in the manifested universe at the beginning of the cycle is a continuance or an effect of the great cause which had been set in motion, cause or causes that had been set in motion in the previous cycle. As we said earlier, one cannot know karma per se. We can describe it, we can perceive its effects. But when we say one cannot know karma per se, we're saying that one cannot know the ultimate first cause behind this process of in and out breathing of Brahma.
Yes.
And don't you think that not knowing karma includes the complexity of it? If you stop and think about, if I do this, it affects that, which affects that, which affects that, and it becomes so complex, no one could understand it.
Certainly, karma can be very complex, and it can seem that no one can understand it. However, it lies within the possibility of the human being to come to fully understand what all of the effects of our causes will be. And it is said that he who has attained a certain level of wisdom will not even put a cause in motion unless he sees the effects, a common effect, unless he verifies it with another adept, and he can see the idea in the other adept's mind. That being the case, you know, we have to be careful. You know, the paralysis of analysis could set in, and we should hold fast to, first and foremost, asking ourselves, what's the motive that is behind what we're doing, first and foremost, and don't so much worry about the effects as the motive. Why am I doing what I'm doing? Yet at the same time, observe the effects of what we do, so that as we see those effects, we thoughtfully, reflectively, systematically, assimilate the wisdom of seeing the cause and effect. And if we're not living mindfully and thoughtfully observing that, then we're missing opportunities for personal growth. So first and foremost, we think, why am I doing what I'm doing? What's the motive behind it? Is it for me or for others? And then we still have the responsibility to observe what the effect is and perhaps next time make appropriate adjustments if necessary.
Thank you. Well, at this point, we'll have our next speaker, come to the platform. As has been suggested already, although karma effects come to us under law, we at any time have free choice as to how we will individually respond to those effects. Thus, the karma of individuals can vary in how they feel it, based on their individual response to karma. And this will be the theme of the next presentation on the individual response to karma.
We would like to start out with just a quick quote. Just so that people are aware, on any idea about karma, the second chapter in Mr. Judge's notes on the Bhagavad Gita is just phenomenal. It has a lot of information in there for karma. And he says, let the motive for action be in the action itself, never in its reward. Not to be incited to action by the hope of the result, nor yet indulge a propensity to inertness. So we learned by the first talk what exactly karma is, as exactly as we can determine what it is. So now we're going to look at the individual response to karma. So we'll look at, is there any way to control it, to mitigate it? You know, do we have to make it a point to earn points for good karma or detriment for bad karma? All of that we'll try and cover in 10 minutes. So what is it that's responding anyway? When we're talking about the individual and how karma affects the person, how is that, what is responding in that person? So we have, there's a sevenfold nature of man, and we have the four lower transient principles, and we have the higher three immortal principles. So the real inner man is permanent, and we know that as Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. And it is also called the individuality. Now, the higher self is really not affected by the choices of the personality. The personality is transient, and each life, each preceding life will have a new personality. And this personality is perishable and transient. And it's this personality that is new with each life. And the personality is the lower aspect of mind. Mind being one principle, but it can be used in a more spiritual or a more low type of nature. So the personality is the passions and desires in mind. And for most of us, it is this lower personality that is making the choices in a day-to-day basis, and this will create, if we're going to be going forward in another life, with a quote, good karma or bad karma. But the whole idea, which is one of the reasons why we are here to learn our lessons, is the idea with evolution, which is one of our theosophical principles, is that we need to learn to raise up our decision-making faculty in when we make those choices so that we can go forward. The body, not the body, the soul wants to improve. It wants to become more spiritual. So it is the so it will try to come through to our lower nature and spark it to look up to a higher one. And we and this can go on from day to day to day, that we're trying to live in a more spiritual way. So when we are reacting to these forces of karma, we are reacting to something that we have done in a past life. So whatever happens was set in motion by our actions, and we're looking at trying to elevate our decision making and make our minds porous to the promptings of the lower. And this is how we evolve. And it's these choices that we're making that will determine how our path will go. So if we just, and also our thoughts, not just actions, our thoughts can create a karmic result as well. So even if we're trying to help somebody, there can be two people trying to do the same thing. And if one person is doing it just because they know it has to be done, they're not looking for any reward, then those thoughts are going up in a more positive manner and won't create any negative karma. Whereas another person who's doing it because they want to have, you know, people like them and think that they're a wonderful person by doing this, that even though the outcomes are both the same, the karmic lesson of this person's thoughts will have to be dealt with in a later life. So how do we get in a closer proximity with our higher self then? I mean, we talk about meditating, we talk about reading higher literature. We have so many wonderful little spiritual books out at the table that we can use during our day to try and center ourselves in a higher manner. And we should avoid books and movies, etc., that express the lower ideas, the lower natures. And this will allow, by struggling to continue to look at a higher, in a higher frame of mind, it will help more of this higher nature to come through. They say that will stands behind desire. So it's our desire. Desire is almost like the vehicle for behind will stands. No, I'm sorry. Will is the vehicle. Sorry about that. Will is the vehicle for desire. If we have a higher desire, then the will be the impetus behind a good action. Whereas if it's more of a negative one, then we're looking at that karmic effect again. So we heard in the first talk that karma is the great equalizer. So what happens then is karma must continue on until that balance is obtained. So how does that work then? I mean, is there any way we can interrupt this flow? We're not talking about fate. We're not talking about predestination. Because the human has this ability to make it's their own choices and make decisions, this is how we will affect the karma that will come next. If we are aware of what karma really is, and if we can be aware that everybody is working on their own karmic lessons, it's not as if we're walking down the street. We still have to live with other people. So whenever anything is coming to us, that is coming to us under karmic law. Everything that comes to us is coming unto us by karmic law. If we're walking down the street, a car's coming, we see somebody walking into it, I'm sorry, That's their karma. I'm not going to do anything. No, we are bound to help because we do not know, as we said, as was said in the first talk, we don't know what karmic issues other people are dealing with. We don't even know what we're dealing with in regards to karmic issues. So we err on the side of helping someone rather than not helping them because we feel as though that's their karma, they should learn how to deal with it. So we don't know what or why others are experiencing what they are, so it's our duty. And duty is a big thing because we have to deal with what is coming to us because it's ours. We can't blame life on anybody else. It is ours to deal with. So it's our response to these opportunities that will enable us to grow along our spiritual path or slide back. And again, this is what evolution is. So when essentially, since this is how evolution occurs, the idea then is to perform everything, no matter how big or how small it comes to us. We need to look at and perform everything under the same intensity and have a good motive for what it is we're doing. We love this, the saying that we hear sometimes, the sacred in the mundane. If we're cutting food up, looking at how did it get here, all the hands, all the people, all the lives that this lettuce went through before it came to us. Somebody had to plant it, somebody had to pick it, somebody had to prepare the soil, and we go to the grocery stores before it comes to us. So we need to, by looking at something as simple as making a salad, we can be looking at the sacred in the mundane. And also, if somebody fails at trying to establish some spiritual guidance in their lives, it doesn't matter as long as the effort was made. We think Blavatsky and both and Judge both commented that it doesn't matter if you fail as long as you've tried. And it's also by making a promise to somebody, this is a bond to the what it is you're trying to do by bonding. Words have a lot of power. And if you promise somebody that you're going to do something, you need to continue through with that. And by being afraid to make bad karma or doing a good deed with an ulterior motive, that is detrimental as well. And just last sentence, the Bhagavad Gita states that all actions should be done because they need to be done, not for what somebody gets out of it.
So, if you're walking down the street and you see somebody about to step into the path of the bus, and you have a split second, do you push them out of the way and take the bus yourself? Throw yourself under the bus? Would that be a wise course of action?
Well, one would have to think. I mean, most people act instinctively in a case like that, and it would all depend on the person seeing. We can't say yes or no because everybody's going to be choosing how to perform an action based on what they've done all their lives. So if they're going to react, we think it's an individual thing. We can't say for certain.
Well, aren't most of us just kind of would be dumbstruck, or we may not even get the words out of our mouths to shout, which would be something we could do. I mean, some people are just paralyzed in a sense. They may have good intentions, but when they're confronted with a situation like this, they're literally paralyzed. Are we held accountable for that? Or did we set up causes to create that put us in a situation where we're, in a sense, helpless, to be of help?
Well, we can't see the karma that is going to be generated by anybody in any certain circumstance, because everybody's an individual. Everybody is coming to this life with their own karmic load. So we can't really say definitely one way or the other. Do you have something to add to that?
Well, we were thinking in a case like that, because you saw such an event and you couldn't do anything, it might have a profound effect on you. You'll start building up your courage and paying more attention to what's going on around you.
Yes, so it could be a lesson that this person has to learn as well, the one that's seeing the accident happening. So, and one thing that they can do is take that accident, and as was said, turn it into something of a lesson that they can learn and maybe pay it forward in some other way. Yes.
So we respond as individuals according to where we are in our development. So in a case such as that, it may not be the karma that we can save that individual, but rather perhaps we were meant to somehow connect with that individual's family. I mean, we have no idea in our day-to-day lives, as was said in the first talk, how many effects, how many fingers go out from each action. So we can look for, as was said, the sacred and the mundane. This was not meant for me to do to save this person, but what am I doing here? Where am I needed? Maybe all you can do is sit with that person until help arrives. So we have to perhaps look with better eyes sometimes too.
And we've heard on the news a lot of where somebody goes to help and rescue somebody and they save that person, but they perish themselves. So there's a whole karmic interaction here between the person that was saved and the person that perished. It could be, I mean, the options are endless as to why something like that would or would not happen. And it really isn't part of our ability to see why things happen the way they do. We just need to know that whatever it is that's happening, it's coming under law. It's coming under the karmic law. Do you follow?
So then the lesson perhaps in all of that is not to be unaware as we move through our day that millions of events and moments make up each day. And in each moment, there is a duty for us, but we're often so self-involved, lowercase self-involved, that we miss all that. It passes us and we miss opportunities.
Yes, it is important to be aware of what's happening and forgive the reference, but the whole thing with people wandering around with cell phones plugged in their ears, I mean they walk into other people. So it is. We need to be looking for those opportunities, as Mr. Judge calls them, for learning, for lessons, and they're out there. I mean, even if you go to the store and you see the cashier is definitely not in a good mood, you know, just making eye contact and like, hey, you know, what do you think of this weather, huh? You know, and it's amazing how they perk up when they're being looked at as being a real person and not just a cashier. Yes?
It's human to human contact, soul to soul. But the other part about the witnessing something, some of it is training, and we can begin to train ourselves to be responsive. We were in a car with a group of people, and one of the people in the car jumped out, ran across the street, none of us saw anything, grabbed a small child, like a football, who was in the path of an oncoming speeding car, and rolled with that child. Well, he was an ex-Marine and a football player. He could do that. But we think the most important thing was he was looking around. Mm-hmm. He was aware of life around him. So we could, as you said, with the cashier, find those incidents in small ways and start training ourselves.
Yeah, and one of a movie we saw a while back with a fellow theosophist, it spoke of, there was a family in the morning, and there was it was showing two different not episodes, but two different ways the whole day could go. And there was a fight in one, and everybody took that anger out, and they showed through the day what would happen if everybody left the house angry. And then it came back again, and if everybody made up before they left on their day, then you could see a totally different positive aspect. So it's like was said in the first talk, it does, it spreads out how we respond to different things.
Thank you. There certainly is a certain karmic flow to our ideas and our talks today. One of the ideas that was brought out is just very recently is that the way we will choose to react to a situation will very much depend on the kind of instrument we have, how we've trained our instrument to respond. So karma is very much dependent on the instrument provided by the human being, by the nation, or the race. So this will be the theme of our third talk in this segment, on the instrument of karma.
In the life of worlds, races, nations, and individuals, karma cannot act unless there is an appropriate instrument provided for its action. And, as to time, until such appropriate instrument is found, that karma related to it remains unexpended. So it is tied together with the appropriate time, the appropriate vehicle, and the playing ground or field for which karma to come forth for any of us. So we'll explore what creates that bond with the instrument and how karma knows it's the right one to incarnate into. The sevenfold nature of man was mentioned, and we're told that the body is the most illusionary expression. It is the lowest in the series of the seven. But all are vehicles for what comes before them. We won't go into specifics, but basically there is one principle and all the rest are aspects of it. So this appropriateness of an instrument for the operation of karma consists in the exact connection and relation of the karma with the body, mind, intellectual, and psychical nature acquired for us by the ego in any life. There are direct connections. There are seeds planted that have their bloom, and the planter must reap that sowing. So these bonds are made in different ways. Consider concentration and effort. Any direction that we set up a force in, that will draw us back into life. And these are what we call the skandhas. These bonds take place in the visible and the invisible elements of our nature, all the different parts of our constitution. The tendencies hidden from view, of which we are not aware, are also used in setting up these links. But we know ignorance of the law is no excuse. So although we can't understand why something has come before us, we can understand it is appropriate because it is under law. And these tendencies are called skandhas, or bundles of attributes, and we are told they are connected and related only to the personal man. There is a distinction there. And in the glossary, we're told that groups of attributes relating to everything finite, inapplicable to the eternal and absolute, and gives us five... Let me get the word right. No, okay. There are five attributes in every living being. These apply to the form, the perception, consciousness, action, and knowledge. So every aspect of how we live our lives, we are making and creating bonds and connections and continual and continuous ties to these lives, past and future. Another connection definitely is through our feeling, our motive, and finally our action. We are told all is due to the mystic power of self-ideation, the eternal thought in the eternal mind, and only in the sense that all forms are projections from the eternal can we say that our bodies are projections of that principle, that atmic principle. So if we are a reflection of that eternal mind, eternal spirit, how are we using that mystic power of ideation? What ideas are we creating that must in time have their expression on the outward planes of existence? Everything, we are told, proceeds from within outwards. Our thoughts, our feelings, our actions are no different. What we concentrate on is eventually expressed in action. What fuels all of that? We got a clue in the earlier talk. Desire, the heart, the center of spirit within our very selves. We actually have an expression, if your heart isn't in it, don't do it. We know this. We intrinsically know the power that we give to something, the motive, the desire, will color it, will have a different impression. If your heart isn't right, if it's not there, don't go forward. So why should we be surprised when our instrument needs fine-tuning all through our lives? We might ask, have we been playing in harmony with the great universal orchestra, or have we created discord? Those are the effects. Just what we put forth returns to us, and it is the law, as we heard earlier, that applies to races, worlds, nations, individuals, to everything. Theosophy offers us a guarantee. Every instrument used by any ego in any life is appropriate to the karma operating through it. So we remember as a young person hearing things like, you're only given as much as you're able to handle. Well, we didn't understand that. Karma, nature, is beneficent. What we are ready, willing, and able, if we put ourselves to the task to work out, we get the appropriate instrument and the appropriate karma comes through. So how do we create a better instrument? Check the source. Is this the right thing to do? Conscience gives us our answer immediately. Check the impression. Is my idea self-generated, or is it something I picked up along the way? It sounded pretty good, so I decided to keep it. Check into these. Check the desire, the intention. What do I hope to achieve by this? Is this a personal, selfish idea, or does it benefit others? Do I expect a return for it? That's how we can gauge if we've gone astray, if we've gone to the personal. So finally, listen to the heart and mind and imagine acting as the highest, most evolved being. Will this action be in line with what we might imagine they would do? We have examples through all of our teachings, through all of our history. If we have answered yes to all of these checks and balances, then trust in the law and release all attachments to results. The Gita tells us over and over again, and it's the hardest thing in the world to do sometimes. But if we are acting in harmony with nature, in harmony with law, we know we are going in the right direction. And as that happens, we are creating a better instrument. We are creating a better result. We are creating a better future. So when we learn to elevate our desires and act in the best way possible, to seek to help rather than harm our brothers and sisters who are suffering through the very same process, then we begin to move in the right direction. Is our heart right? If it is, we move forward. So with mind in control, with motive in check, and with heart beating in time with all of life, move forward boldly and leave all results to the law.
Does creating a better instrument necessarily mean that the karma we will receive through that instrument will be more favorable or perceived as being pleasant, or might the karma be more difficult as we develop our instrument?
We're always reminded of what we're so fond of at this point in our history, which is working out, exercising. We build muscle so we can lift heavier weights, and we lift heavier weights so we can build bigger muscles. So it would seem as we work to benefit all of mankind, not to create a better instrument, but to do what's right because it's our duty and it's the right thing to do. As that instrument improves and gets more in line and works better, we imagine if the instrument is more fit, then the karma waiting to be expended that we are now able to lift and carry will arrive at our doorstep. We've asked for it. If we hadn't done the work, it couldn't come through. Yes.
So the skandhas that were mentioned, is it because of them, like if somebody has a real propensity like for music or they speak really well, an artist or somebody very physical and strong, are they all as a result of these skandhas?
The skandhas, there is some wonderful references on those. And we'll see if we brought them with us. Nope. Anything that we have given concentration to in any particular life builds one of these bonds, one of these connections, one of these tendencies. So if we come back with either a great talent for something, or perhaps a great wish for the talent of something, we can see as it is the result of pushing in that direction. If we have built better muscles doing the hard work of what's right, that will also come back, although we don't feel it or notice it because it's a positive effect. So we think anything that we have given effort towards becomes part of those tendencies. Now, some of that work is assimilated in Devakan or sloughed off in Kamaloka, but those really strong, unexpended bonds that we haven't been able to completely finish working on yet, magnetically, it says they magnetically, as a group, pull us almost back into life. They're waiting at the threshold of Devakan. I'm sorry. You're choosing to, aren't you? Okay. Your hand was up earlier. Okay.
Yes. We think one of the confusions lies in the fact that the skandhas are reflected in the personality, but they belong to the individual. Mm-hmm. It's the choices we have made, and that's reflected either in this personality or in a future one.
Absolutely.
Question, yes.
So what we're saying is that skandhas are the carriers of karma.
Skandhas are the carriers of karma. It's interesting, we do have it here. It's from the Key to Theosophy. Karma, with its army of skandhas, waits at the threshold of Devakan, whence the ego reemerges to assume a new incarnation. It is at this moment that the future destiny of the now rested ego trembles in the scales of just retribution as it now falls once again under the sway of active karmic law, so they would be bound together. And a rebirth selected and prepared by the mysterious, inexorable, but equitable and wisdom decree of infallible law. Yes?
It sounds like that the higher man has a barcode. And as he's coming, re-embodying, he gets scanned, and the appropriate scan is a karma with the same barcode attached up to him.
Yes. We think that is appropriate. We were going to say we don't want to make it that hard and material, but it does belong to the personal man. So, yes, it is that which belongs to that entity coming forth.
Well, if that's the case, how can we say that karma is not fatalism? Because it does sound like we are fated to deal with the skandhas that we collect. So we wonder if through the power of our thought or the power of a vow, if we place our minds in other ideas or conditions, can we create a new set of skandhas that will have their karmic effect in this life?
Absolutely, 100%. The universe seeks to balance. So for every effort put in a positive direction, there is some amelioration or lifting of that which was heavy and negative. If effort was put here and then effort is put here, we have come back to balance. So anything put forward in a positive direction in a spiritual motive does get mixed in and elevates and changes. And the instrument being suited for that was caused by the past effort. But we know that we have free will in every moment. It is not fatalism, because we have the instrument necessary to do just what was described. We have earned it. And as we find ourselves mired down in the mundane or lifted up in mind and heart to the sacred, then the results will follow. Yes.
You mentioned that things are done from the heart in goodwill and good effort. What if something is done that is good, but the effort is still applied, but it's not from the heart to do good? Maybe it's a response. How is karma interacting with that?
That would be a wonderful karmic lesson for us. We have the best intention when we move forward. We perform the action, but the result, the response, as was mentioned, is not at all what we thought it might be. There's a huge lesson in that for us. Is that what you meant or no? I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm thinking through what you
okay.
said.
So if the response from the other or from within ourselves is not what we thought it might be, then we need to go back and check, where did I go askew? Something was not along the lines that I believed it was. And I have the power to recreate that or try again and readjust so that I get back into alignment.
We think also the question referred to, many people don't respond from the heart or their feeling nature. Mm-hmm. They might respond purely out of sense impressions or intellectual ideas on principles or what they think are principles. Mm-hmm. So how would that... would that differ karmically from someone who is responding from the heart?
For the person putting the effort forth?
Yeah.
The response from the other?
Response from the other, your own karma.
If the other's response was of a completely different nature of what we intended, we just want to make sure we understand.
What we receive is a karmic result of our action.
Okay.
How is it affected by the principle that we're operating from? Because all those acts may be good, but in one case we're acting from a heart quality, in another case we're acting from a sense impression, from an idea. Does the karmic effect vary according to the motive?
Yes. Yes. Does the karmic effect vary according to the motive? Yes, absolutely. As it is colored and the response is returned to us, we guess we have to determine whether it's mind or heart,
what we need to work on? Is that the idea? Do you have any thoughts? Any thoughts on that? No? We might have missed the point. We apologize. Yes?
When we work through a karmic effect, should we have concern about how others or agents respond to it?
That's such a difficult question. When we are working through a karmic effect, should we have concern with how others respond to it? Yes and no. We have absolutely no control over their response, but we want to make sure that we are acting in the best way possible so as not to create that particular response in the other. Yes.
It would seem to us that if we work through a karmic effect properly from the heart,
properly, right,
we have no control over how anyone will respond to
absolutely.
It. But since the other may not have worked through, the agent may not have worked through his part of the karma, we can have compassion and understanding, but we can't change the way other people think, and we can go on to other karma.
Perfectly stated. Perfectly stated. Absolutely.
So we might then conclude then with the idea that the way we respond is not just a matter of the heart, but a matter of wisdom too. And we may think we were acting from the highest feeling with our nature, but the karmic information or response to us begins to have an effect on us that we look closer at what was our motive, what was the principle by which we acted. Did we act with wisdom or just some feeling?
You know? Okay.
So it is, all this depends on the kind of instrument we've come into life with, which is our karma. Some of us are more intellectual or cognitive in our decisions, and some more intuitive and heartfelt and directed more by principle. So at this point, we're going to take a break to allow you to digest some of these ideas. And if you would like a glass of water to help your digestion, it is available out there. And then we'll start up again in about 10 or 15 minutes.
Should I pause this?
Okay.